This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flincher.
Well, Margaret, everyone's still trying to make sense of the proceedings last week at the Supreme Court. After 3 days of oral arguments, most analysts are thinking that some, or possibly even all, of the Affordable Care Act could be in jeopardy.
And yet, there are still plenty of court analysts who say it's hard to predict which way the Supreme Court will ultimately vote based solely on their line of questioning. Either way, we expect to hear that decision by June, which at the moment seems like a long time off.
It does. And this court gives me a little anxiety. I think about two cases that they let decisions on. One was Bush versus Gore, and the other was the United decision. Both overturned long-term precedents, and one of them, Bush versus Gore, they said could never be used again as precedent setting. Whatever the Supreme Court decides, healthcare reform is certainly a hot button issue on the campaign trail and will figure prominently in the run-up to the election, with Mitt Romney, the likely GOP nominee, trying to distance himself further from his connection to a very similar health reform bill he passed in Massachusetts, which required all residents to obtain health insurance.
And Mark, whatever you think about the Massachusetts reform, I don't think there's any denying that many elements, and perhaps in general, it's working quite well. And in fact, elements of the Affordable Care Act are in place and working well. The president has been trumpeting those things, the 2.5 million young Americans who are able to stay on their parents' insurance till age 26, and also the millions of seniors who've benefited from prescription drug assistance.
And children with pre-existing conditions not being denied insurance coverage because of those conditions, a benefit that will be extended to adults in 2014 if the Affordable Care Act is allowed to stand.
Well, Mark, I guess we'll just have to try and be patient, not our strong point, and adopt a wait-and-see attitude regarding health care reform in this country and where it's headed. And apparently, that's what a lot of states and the major insurance companies are choosing to do as well. Just a lot of uncertainty out there.
There is. And politics aside, there are many in the trenches of healthcare who see the need for real reform in healthcare delivery system, which still sadly yields an estimated 100,000 accidental deaths per year and costs billions of dollars in waste. Our guest today is quality and safety expert at the University of Florida.
Dr. Frederick Southwick is a Harvard Fellow and the author of the soon-to-be-released book, Critically Ill, A Five-Point Plan to Cure Healthcare. His book discusses a number of key areas that would benefit enormously from improved systems that are borrowed from the world of manufacturing, team sports, and others.
Dr. Southwick is also a big proponent of empowering nurses on the team as a strategy to better improve patient safety and outcomes.
We'll get to Dr. Southwick in just a moment, but no matter what the story, remember you can find all of our shows and hear more about us by Googling chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have feedback, email us at chcradio.com. We'd love to hear from you. Before we speak with Dr. Southwick, let's check in with our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with this headline news. The nine justices of the Supreme Court met behind closed doors last Friday, just days after their marathon session on the Affordable Care Act. While they continue to pick apart issues surrounding the legal precedents for the individual mandate, the politicians are seizing the opportunity to weigh in. Vice President Joe Biden waxed confident predicting the health reform law would be upheld, in spite of the hard line of questioning by the court's conservative members, who are in the majority. Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer had a more dire prediction that if the Affordable Care Act was overturned, it could pave the way for repeal of other safety net laws like the ones governing Medicare, Social Security, and food safety. GOP presidential hopeful Rick Santorum posted his own version of health care reform in USA Today, citing the intention to repeal Obamacare, saying he would replace it with a series of measures that were in line with conservative values and an open marketplace, where the poor would be given tax credits for purchasing insurance, along with allowing people to buy insurance across state lines. From the research lab, autism diagnoses are on the rise, and the numbers are startling. The number of children in this country who are on the autism spectrum now, 1 in 88 kids, with higher concentrations among boys, 1 in 54. A spokesperson for Autism Speaks is calling this an epidemic. And it seems the modern newborn is taking his or her sweet time in arriving. A recent study shows the average labor is 6.5 hours longer than mothers experienced 50 years ago. The study points to more induced labors and the use of epidurals for pain, which can slow labor and delay births up to 90 minutes. I'm Marianne O'Hare with this headline news.
Today, Margaret and I are speaking with Dr. Frederick Southwick, professor of medicine at the University of Florida in the infectious disease division. He's also a Harvard fellow at the Advanced Leadership Institute and author of Critically Ill, a 5-point plan to cure healthcare delivery, which comes out soon. Dr. Southwick, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you, Mark.
As an internist and infectious disease specialist for over 30 years, you've seen a lot of misdiagnosed and medical errors during that time. In fact, your former wife was at one time a victim of a series of medical errors that almost cost her her life. And I think it's well known that the medical errors or mistake cause probably over 100,000 deaths per year. Could you start off with the larger picture and shape up the dimensions for our audience of what the costs are to the healthcare system, both in terms of human toll and financial cost as well?
Yes, I think, Mark, these are the key elements and one of the primary motivators for me to write this book. And the case that I describe in the book about Mary, I think, reflects that human toll. This is only one person, one family. So if there are 100,000 deaths, there are probably over a million injuries that are very profound. And I can tell you from my own personal experience, you never forget what happened to a loved one. But also the caregivers that make these errors due to poor systems, they are what we call second victims. They also suffer. If a nurse gives a wrong medication and it kills a patient, imagine how that nurse feels. Mm-hmm. In general, they actually, in most cases, they leave the profession and move on because they cannot deal with the suffering and pain that they actually cause. And then if you look at the finances, I actually broke down the cost of Mary's care. If it had been routine, her care would have cost about $16,000. Because of the complications and errors, the actual cost was more like $95,000. If there are 100,000 deaths, it's somewhere in the order of $20 to $30 billion in losses.
Dr. Southwick, you didn't start to really understand the systemic nature of the underlying problems in care delivery until you started seriously studying other models like in automobile manufacturing. What can we learn from those systems, like manufacturing systems, that can fundamentally help improve health systems and safety?
What we've learned is errors are not caused by bad people. They are caused by bad systems. So now what can you learn? The three key elements of Toyota as, first of all, protocols. Every procedure must be carefully outlined and done in the same way. And each of those protocols can be improved and perfected. So that's the first. The second is customer-supplier relationship. And you respond to them very quickly when they need something. And this is a major problem in healthcare, that we don't understand who the customers are and we don't respond properly. And the third is constantly improving, looking at your processes, empowering everyone on the front lines, middle management, wherever. In this way, Toyota has dramatically reduced the cost of their cars and at the same time dramatically improve the quality of their cars. If we could do the same thing in healthcare, we could dramatically improve the quality of care and reduce the errors.
Dr. Southwick, you've also starting to look at other disciplines from the world of sports. How do you envision medical teams using playbooks, and what other ideas from the world of professional team sports can also be brought to tackling the problem, if you will, in healthcare?
I was actually an athlete. I played football at Yale and also lacrosse at Yale. The team that wins makes the fewest errors. And what's powerful about that from an American standpoint is virtually everyone at some time in their lives has played a team sport, or they are watch team sports. Therefore, we already understand how to work in teams. We already understand the concept of protocols, because a playbook is a protocol, and that's exactly what we need in healthcare. We in healthcare, we need to look through the eyes of our patients, and that is a very important customer-supplier relationship. And the third key element is what's called in sports game film. The coaches video all games and then play them back to the players later, and they go over what went well, and they go over what could be improved. Now, if each of us in healthcare would look at ourselves and say what went well and what we could improve, we could get better and better and better.
Dr. Southwick, you wrote the book with a longtime nursing colleague, Dr. Dina Treloar. You seem to clearly see that the further empowerment of nurses is one critical milestone in improving the quality of care and safety for patients. I wonder if you'd share with us what are your ideas or best practices that really do empower nurses, but not just nurses, empower all members of the medical team that take care of patients.
Nurses are the front line of care. They are the ones that are with the patients the majority of the time, and therefore if the systems are bad, they're the ones that make the error because the systems are bad and they suffer the consequences. And most important, nurses have no conflict of interest. In other words, they get paid to care and empathize and comfort their patients. Since nurses do that, I encourage them that they be the patient advocate. When they see themselves in that role, they're much more willing to speak out. One of the huge problems in healthcare is what I call the command and control model of leadership. In other words, the head of the hospital commands everybody below them to do things. This simply will not work. You have to empower those on the front lines to be leaders and to speak out and make suggestions for improvement. And those high above have to listen to those suggestions and help to implement them. Nurses, virtually all caregivers, have to understand that each of us contributes in a different way, and each of our contributions is equally valuable. In fact, in some cases, I believe nurses' care is the most, I do believe, is the most valuable part of patient care. And one of the ways we've emphasized that is we always, on work rounds, we schedule our rounds so that the nurses know, the bedside nurses know when we're going to be there, and we create a huddle, and we make sure that the nurse is in that huddle. And when you have a circle, then everybody feels much more equal.
What a great approach. We're speaking today with Dr. Frederick Southwick, professor of medicine at the University of Florida, Harvard fellow in the Advanced Leadership Initiative, and author of a soon-to-be-released book, Critically Ill, A Five-Point Plan to Cure Healthcare Delivery. You know, your approach has been really to sort of the bigger picture of how to eliminate types of waste and ineffectiveness in the current system. You've also been very critical of the overuse of testing. How is the reliance on expensive and unnecessary tests endangering our patients?
One of the big problems is that physicians who order most of these tests have not worried about cost or worried that much about or minimized the likelihood of a complication from a test or a procedure. And what's happened is they don't think about what the likely effect of their procedure is going to be or their test is going to be. In other words, many of the times it turns out that they're simply confirmatory and are what I call icing on the cake. Not MRIs are actually very safe unless you happen to have a pacemaker, but other procedures are not. For instance, cardiac catheterization, very commonly used today. And that procedure has a certain known side effects. For instance, I've seen several patients bleed into the back of the retroperitoneal area. And what's happened is when you increase the capacity to do cardiac catheterizations, it's been shown that the cardiologist will do more of these procedures. And some, quite often, they are not necessary. In other words, they don't really change the therapy significantly.
Dr. Southwick, you are obviously a lifelong learner, and I really enjoyed reading about a labor-intensive, you described it, course you took, I think, at the Kennedy School. And you said it taught me the fundamental campaign techniques used by politicians and unions and reformers to organize people. So tell us, how are you going to use the art of persuasion to move things forward, not just in one teaching hospital or in one profession, but really across the country as we enter this period of time when the Affordable Care Act hopefully will be implemented? What's the art of persuasion you're going to use?
In order to organize people to change how they think about the world, you have to actively involve them and recruit them to take action. This chapter to me is the most important for healthcare because the culture right now, I think, is caregiver focused. And one of the key elements, and I've actually been working, we have a campaign at the University of Florida now based on these principles called the Physician I Promise campaign. And each physician is working as an individual, is promising to in some way enhance our patient's experience when they're in the hospital. And what we've done is I've empowered a leadership group of young physicians who are very energetic, very talented, and we've created together a series of forums. We had a doctor-patient communication forum, and we recruited patients to describe their personal experiences interacting with physicians. And we've had a second forum on doctor-nurse communication, and we had nurses describe how they see communication with physicians and how that could be improved. And by doing this throughout the country, I think we can dramatically change the attitudes. One of the sad things to me that I just don't understand is that so many people in our country are against universal coverage.
Mm-hmm.
We know, it's been well shown that we talk about deaths, we know that those are not covered
mm-hmm.
because they lack health care coverage. We know there are 45,000 deaths per year
mm-hmm.
due to lack of coverage. How can we as a people not be concerned about our fellow man? We're asking physicians to get outside of themselves and to focus on our patients, focus on working better with our nurses, focusing on teamwork. And that's what we as a nation need to do.
Well, you're right on about the access and certainly about the change of culture that's needed in the system. I know at our health center, we're a patient level 3 patient-centered medical home. But, you know, we're still looking at how to improve that. We brought together the Dartmouth Institute with the GE lean manufacturing people and really looking through the process of how do we build a high-quality, safe, efficient, and patient-centered primary care home.
Right.
And you are very focused in on patient-centered care while at the same time making it more efficient and streamlined. Talk to us a little bit about that.
We've worked on this the most is a rounding system that I've developed. It's based on athletic principles. We call it Gator Rounds because the University of Florida mascot is the Gator.
We got that one.
Yeah, and one of the key elements of all athletics is the fundamentals. And one of the key fundamentals is how we communicate efficiently. And whenever possible, we actually try to do all rounding in the patient's room. Obviously, athletics means teamwork. A key member of the team has to be the patient. And somehow this is ignored. Who's going to take care of themselves 95% of the time? So if we don't include them in the team, when they leave the hospital, they aren't going to know what to do. After all, it's their body, it's their lives, and we really need to listen to what their concerns are.
Dr. Southwick, you've talked about burnout as a huge concern. It's a huge concern along the whole continuum of care, and I thought you made the great observation that if a patient or their family sees their caregivers looking exhausted and harried, beware, because that burnout can have a direct impact on quality and safety as well. Tell us about this 5-point plan you've written about and how that might really increase the vitality and well-being for the whole healthcare team.
Now, when everybody feels empowered to bring about change, they develop a new autonomy, a new sense of significance that makes their job so much more enjoyable. Then obviously we need to understand manufacturing athletic systems. We need to understand the nature of human errors and how to assess those human errors and create systems to improve them. And then one of the most important elements, the fourth element, is teamwork. We, many doctors and particularly physicians, I think, don't understand how to work well in teams. The Marcus Welby model still persists in the minds of many physicians. We need to understand that we have to work in teams and be coaches rather than dictate what goes on. And then the fifth element, which we've talked about, is learning how to bring about cultural changes. So if you create a positive culture, if each of us feels we are a leader and autonomous, if each of us is within a system that is efficient and reduces waste, if each of us is in a system that minimizes errors, and each of us feels part of a team and has a team spirit, we will create a true joy at work, and each of us will become more focused on the ultimate goal, which is improve the well-being of our patients.
Well said. Dr. Southwick, we'd like to ask all of our guests this final question. When you look around the country and around the world as it relates to improving healthcare, who should our listeners at Conversations be keeping an eye on?
Well, one of the things that I think you'll notice is that most of the dialogue is by politicians, administrators, economists, and the actual caregivers and the patients are not speaking out. And my hope is that through this book and through interviews such as yours, that we will begin to hear those that are on the front lines that are either benefiting or being harmed by the care, and those who are giving the care and are affected by these systems that we have, will begin to actually speak out on what is needed to improve patient care.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Frederick Southwick, professor of medicine at the University of Florida in the Division of Infectious Diseases and Harvard Fellow at the Advanced Leadership Institute. He's also the author of Critically Ill, a 5-point plan to cure healthcare delivery, which comes out soon. Dr. Southwick, thank you so much for joining us today on Conversations.
Thank you. I enjoyed talking to you.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Well, Mark and Margaret, we've seen a lot of debate over contraception this year, and this comes after the Obama administration announced that most employers would have to offer insurance that covers birth control for free. Obama later amended this mandate to say that religious organizations didn't have to provide the coverage, but the insurance companies would cover the cost. So that brought some competing claims. The administration has said that the mandate would be cost neutral for insurance companies because the free contraception would prevent unwanted pregnancies. But critics charged that premiums would go up. So who's right? Does free contraception coverage increase premiums or not? Well, there's no straight answer to this question. We found conflicting and ultimately just inconclusive evidence. I can give you just a couple of examples. Hawaii has a birth control mandate, and a study there said that it didn't appear to increase premiums. Also, a 1995 study cited by the Obama administration said there were significant savings from contraception coverage. It also said insurance costs would increase if the free coverage simply went to people who would otherwise buy the birth control on their own. We also looked at some state studies. Two of them in Pennsylvania and Kentucky said they just couldn't determine if reduced pregnancy costs would cover the added expense of the free contraception. And a Texas study estimated that such coverage wouldn't generate enough savings to cover the cost. And their reason, most women would buy the contraception on their own, even if their insurance plan didn't cover it. So altogether, the evidence is just a little murky. Neither side will be very happy with that conclusion, but there just wasn't enough evidence for us to conclude that free contraception was cost neutral or that it would increase cost. And that's it for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives.
When the federal health reform measure goes into effect in 2014, millions of Americans are going to be added to insurance rolls, adding pressure to primary care systems that already are experiencing a shortage of practitioners. It's expected that community health centers will become vitally important venues for serving the health needs of these additionally insured Americans. The Blue Shield of California Foundation, one of California's largest health care grant-making organization, sees this as a critical time to bolster community health centers to better accommodate the wave of new patients while maximizing opportunities presented with the Affordable Care Act. Since 2003, when they launched the Clinic Core Support Initiative, the foundation has donated $47 million to clinics throughout California to improve their ability to provide quality care to the underserved population. CEO Peter Long last week announced an additional $7 million grant to strengthen the state's network of community health centers. The money is being earmarked to assist existing clinics with operating funds, assist some clinics in better utilization of electronic medical records, and create a database from the state's highest performing health clinics to provide a model of excellence for other clinics to strive towards, including training the next generation of community health center leaders. A health foundation, funding improvements to clinics and healthcare training to improve access to quality care for our most vulnerable citizens. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of Wesleyan University at WESU, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.